Welcome to episode 46 of the Burning Bush Podcast, where we share the message of the Bible while enjoying a good cigar. Hope everybody's doing well. Here in Southern California, we're in the midst of a week of rain, so hopefully it doesn't get too hard and become a distraction from the recording. I did a little test recording before I started, and it's just kind of sprinkling right now, but we've had some heavy downpours, so if it does start raining harder, hopefully it won't affect your ability to hear me too badly. So we're just going to go for it. So this week I am smoking the Don Pepin Garcia Blue Label Corojo. And I know it's not a Maduro like I usually feature on the show, because that's my smoke of choice. But this is one of those that I really do enjoy, even though it's not a Maduro. I'm not big on Corojos, but this is one that I've found that that I actually really like. So let me go ahead and give you the details on it. I went to the My Father Cigars website, and that's who makes the Don Pepin Garcia Blue, and they had just a short couple of lines description about it, so I'm going to take you over to Cigars International and give you the rundown from there, and I'll have that linked up in the show notes as well. Don Pepin Garcia Blue, a beautiful Cubanesque gem. Jose Garcia, otherwise known as Don Pepin, is the man behind some of the industry's hottest cigars. My Father, DPG Cuban Classic, Tatuaje, and Flor de las Antillas, to name a few. To create the blue, a blend of 100% Nicaraguan tobacco is utilized. All Cuban seed, this hearty mixture is made complete with a dark Nicaraguan Corojo wrapper. The cigar is full-bodied and full-flavored, boasting a rich, spicy bouquet of flavor with an assortment of earthy nuances. Eventful from start to finish and ultimately satisfying, Don Pepin Garcia Blue is a delicious, well-balanced cigar. In addition to being named among the world's top 25 cigars, number 8 to be exact, Don Pepin Garcia Blue received a well-deserved 93 and 92 rating, noting an almost perfectly constructed Lancero with an exemplary pigtail cap. The draw is perfect, loading the palate with rich coffee notes, well balanced by spice, chocolate, and a leathery finish. And the profile is full strength. The wrapper, as I said, is a Nicaraguan Corojo. No details on the binder, and filler is Nicaraguan. And they have quite a good list of vitolas here. The Delicias, which is the Churchill 7x50. Exclusivos Presidente is a 9.2x48. Exquisitos Corona is a 5.6x46. The Generosos, which is a Toro, that's what I'm smoking, is the 6x50. Imperiales Torpedo is a 6.1x52. Lanceros, which is a Lancero Panatella, 7.5x38. The Toro Gordo, 6x56. And the Toro Grande, 6x62. That's a fat one right there. So those are the details on the Don Pepin Garcia Blue. And like I said, I'll have the link to Cigars International in the show notes, so check it out. Okay, so now that the cigar's taken care of for this week, we'll go ahead and jump back into Dr. Justin Bass's book, The Bedrock of Christianity. Continuing in chapter 1, studying history is time traveling. We are like paleontologists struggling to piece together a set of bones which a dinosaur had used all its life without even thinking about it. Simply seeing and assembling the data is a monstrous task. N.T. Wright, The New Testament and the People of God. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure is a cult movie classic from the 1980s. Like great wine, this movie only grows better with age. The story is simple. Bill and Ted are failing their high school history class and need an A on their next presentation to graduate. Thankfully, a time-traveling phone booth, if you're not old enough, Google phone booth to learn what that is, falls out of the sky with comedian George Carlin inside. Bill and Ted are enabled to travel back in time through history to kidnap and learn from Socrates, Genghis Khan, Joan of Arc, Abraham Lincoln, Sigmund Freud, and Billy the Kid. I don't want to spoil the ending for you, but they end up having a most excellent adventure. If you could time travel to any time or place in history, where and when would you go? Is there an event you would most like to experience or a person you would most want to meet? What if you could travel to significant turning points in history, such as the very moment when Socrates was walking to his trial before the citizens of Athens, when Lincoln was on his way to Ford's Theater, or when Julius Caesar crossed the Rubicon? Imagine being able to interview them concerning their aims, beliefs, hopes, and dreams. I hate to be the one to tell you this, but you will never be able to literally travel through time. It is a logical impossibility. For example, could one travel back in time before one's own birth and kill one's own parents or grandparents? Think about that question too long and you'll be permanently cross-eyed. But here is the good news. We do have the tools to travel back in time thousands of years in the past and observe historical events such as the Jewish War with Rome in AD 66 to 70. We can meet historical figures such as Socrates, Abraham Lincoln, and Julius Caesar, or even John the Baptist, Jesus, and Paul. We can discuss justice or courage with Socrates as we walk with him down the streets of Athens. We can behold the magnificent beauty of the temple in Jerusalem with Josephus, or behold the horror of Jesus' crucifixion outside the city walls. We don't have time-traveling phone booths. We don't even have phone booths anymore. But we do have the tried and tested tools of the historical method. These tools enable us to time travel through history. In one sense, history is everything that happened in the past, every second of every day since the beginning of the universe. However, I mean something more specific when I talk about studying history or the historical method. In this second and more useful sense, history is the knowable past, the people and events of history for which reliable sources have survived. In some cases, such as with Alexander the Great or many of the Roman Caesars and Egyptian pharaohs, we have physical evidence of their existence, such as coins, art, busts, statues, and even their mummies. However, most figures from history we only know through surviving written sources. Sometimes these are written by eyewitnesses to the events or persons they are describing, but in most cases, they are written by individuals many generations later. Like a paleontologist trying to piece together his newly discovered group of bones, historians work with what the sands of time had delivered them to piece together a particular historical event or understand the life, aims, beliefs, and death of a historical figure. How well they can do that really depends on the nature of the surviving sources. We engaged in this art of time travel in the prologue when we sought to learn as much as we could from the epic meeting between Peter and Paul in Jerusalem. The one written source from Galatians 1:18 could only take us so far. Yet, since Galatians was written by a reliable witness, Paul, we were able to explore in detail this event that occurred in Jerusalem sometime between AD 33 and 38. In Bart Ehrman's many books on early Christianity, he discusses what makes for a reliable source. What historians want, in short, are lots of witnesses close to the time of the events who are not biased toward their subject matter and who corroborate one another's points without showing signs of collaboration. This can be laid out as four distinct items that constitute a historian's wish list. 1. Early dating, sources that are very close to the time of the person or event. 2. Eyewitnesses, multiple people who saw and or recorded the event. 3. Corroboration, eyewitnesses and sources that corroborate with one another without collusion. 4. Unbiased, sources that are not biased toward their subject matter. As Ehrman concludes, would that we had such sources for all significant historical events. Now, if we follow this criterion woodenly, we would have to throw out most of ancient history we now take for granted. In almost all cases, we don't have a person writing about an event who is unbiased or disinterested, and most of our sources date many generations, even hundreds of years, after the person or event that is being described. For example, Oxford historian A.N. Sherwin White says that historians of ancient history are usually dealing with derivative sources of marked bias and prejudice composed at least one or two generations after the events they describe, but much more often, as with the lives of Plutarch or central decades of Livy from 2 to 5 centuries later, though connecting links are provided backwards in time by a series of lost intermediate sources, we are seldom in the happy position of dealing at only one remove with a contemporary source. Sherwin White goes on to say that even with many generations separating an event from the person writing about it, this does not prevent the historian from being able to say quite a lot concerning what really happened. To have the kind of sources and eyewitness Ehrman is describing is almost unprecedented, at least from the ancient world. To be fair to Ehrman, that is why he calls it a wish list. I will argue in Chapter 3 that, incredibly, the creedal tradition found in 1 Corinthians 15, 3-7 does pass this high threshold for sources. But for now, I want to emphasize that most of the history we take for granted does not even come close to meeting the wish list criteria for reliable sources. Yet, that does not present a problem to ancient historians, or for us, who desire to time travel to experience this event or meet that historical figure. As Sherwin White pointed out above, even with multiple generations separating an event from the author describing it, we are still able to learn a lot concerning what really happened. To illustrate this further, let's look briefly at four examples from history: an emperor, an ancient war, a philosopher, and a Baptist. The knowable past. Tiberius Caesar is one of the Roman emperors for whom we have multiple, somewhat reliable biographical accounts. He ruled the Roman Empire from AD 14 through 37 and was the most powerful man in the world at that time. We have archaeological evidence of his reign in the coins he issued, but to learn about the man himself, we must rely on biographical material. Only a handful of written sources about him have survived, some of which were written long after his death. Sherwin White discusses the evidence for Tiberius. The story of Tiberius's reign is known from four sources: the annals of Tacitus and the biography of Suetonius, written some 80 or 90 years later; the brief contemporary record of Valius Paterculus; and the 3rd century history of Cassius Dio. These disagree amongst themselves in the wildest possible fashion, both in major matters of political action or motive, and in specific details of minor events. But this does not prevent the belief that the material of Tacitus can be used to write a history of Tiberius. Despite the lateness and disagreement among the biographies of Tiberius, this Caesar is still part of the knowable past. We can time travel to meet him through Tacitus and Suetonius, even though they were 80 to 90 years later. To put that time frame in perspective, the latest biography of Jesus in the New Testament is the Gospel of John, which dates to around 60 years after Jesus' death. Mark is the earliest, dating to somewhere between 30 and 40 years after Jesus' death. Even better, we have Paul's early letters, which were written within 20 to 25 years after Jesus' death. But with the traditions and hymns about Jesus quoted in Paul's early letters, we can reach back even further. In particular, 1 Corinthians 15, 3-7, as we will see, is dated by 99% of scholars to within a decade after Jesus' death. Tiberius was the most powerful man in the world of his day. Jesus was one of the poorest, belonging to the peasant class as a Jewish carpenter. He even died the most shameful death, a slave's death, on a cross during Tiberius' reign. Yet we have far more reliable written sources and closer to the time of Jesus' actual life and death than this Caesar of Rome. The second example is the events of the Jewish war with Rome, which began in AD 66 and ended in 70 when the Roman general Titus broke down the walls of Jerusalem and burned the temple to the ground. As a result of this event, we have archaeological evidence of the war to this very day. Yet, how many contemporary eyewitness sources do we have for the most significant war in the first century? Only one. Jewish historian Josephus wrote down his eyewitness account in a book called The Jewish War only a few years after the event, around AD 75. As for the history of the war, I wrote it as having been an actor myself in many of its transactions, an eyewitness in the greatest part of the rest, and as not unacquainted with anything whatsoever that was either said or done in it. Against Appian 1.55. Using the tools of the historical method, historians do their best to distinguish clear exaggeration and the mix of legend and history from the places where Josephus is telling us what really happened. All in all, Josephus gives us many bedrock facts about the Jewish war with Rome, despite being on Emperor Vespasian's payroll, greatly exaggerating numbers, and occasionally adding legendary events to the story. But through the historical method, we can time travel and witness the massacre at Masada, Jewish War 4.398 through 404, and 7.252 through 406. Observe that Titus' soldiers, in jest, played with different postures for crucified victims until they ran out of crosses, Jewish War 5.449 through 551, and learn of many other of the horrors of the Jewish war with Rome. For a third example, if we want to walk the streets of Athens with Socrates, listening to his philosophical wisdom, how do we do it? Like Jesus, Socrates didn't write anything. The only way we can meet the historical Socrates is through the undeniably biased writings about him from Plato's Dialogues, Xenophon's Memorabilia and Symposium, and Aristophanes' Clouds. These were all contemporary disciples of Socrates and wrote within decades after his death. We learn from all of them that the historical Socrates occupied himself primarily with ethics, seeking to help everyone around him toward excellence of character. He was the first to raise the problem of definitions and used a unique method of argument and debate known as the dialectic method. According to Plato, Socrates was told by the oracle at Delphi that he was the wisest man on earth. Socrates was perplexed by this pronouncement. He thought of himself as someone who really knew nothing. Then he finally figured it out. He was the wisest because he was the only one who knew he was not wise, the only one who knew he did not know. I am wiser than this man, for neither of us really knows anything fine and good. But this man thinks he knows something when he does not, whereas I, as I do not know anything, do not think I do either. I seem, then, in just this little thing to be wiser than this man at any rate. That what I do not know, I do not think I know either. Plato, Apology 21, D through E. Eventually, the leaders of Athens accused him of leading the youth astray, teaching strange gods, Xenophon, Memorabilia 1.1, and even wizardry, Plato, Meno, 80b. The Athenian Senate condemned him to death by drinking hemlock. His last words, according to Plato, "Crito, we owe a cock to Aesculapius, pay it and do not neglect it," are recorded in his famous dialogue, Apology, which means defense. He was 70 years old when he died in 399 BC. Plato, Apology 70d. Scholars debate to this day whether Plato, Xenophon, and Aristophanes give us the historical Socrates or an idealized version of Socrates whom they used to teach their own philosophical theories and concepts. The majority view is that the historical Socrates is best represented in Plato's earliest dialogues, Apology, Euthyphro, Crito, etc. And only in the later ones did Plato begin to put his ideas on Socrates' lips. Classicists John Burnett and A.E. Taylor argue that Plato almost always gives us a faithful portrayal of the historical Socrates because he would not have done such an injustice to his master, especially while others were still alive to correct this view. Even though these disciples of Socrates were clearly biased and interested in preserving their master's philosophical wisdom and legacy, we can learn a lot concerning the historical Socrates through their different, no doubt artistic, portrayals. The fourth example, John the Baptist, like Socrates and Jesus, did not write anything, or at least nothing he wrote has survived. Our only first century sources for John the Baptist come from the four Gospels, scattered references in primarily the sermons of Acts and Josephus, Matthew 3, 1 through 17, 4:12, 9:14, 11, 1 through 19, 14, 1 through 13, 16:14, 17:13, 21, 25 through 26, and 32, Mark 1, 1 through 14, 2:18, 6:14 through 32, 8:28, 11:30 through 32, Luke 1, 5 through 25, and 39 through 45, 57 through 80, 3, 2 through 22, 5:33, 7:18 through 35, 9, 7 through 9, 19, 11, 1, 16:16, 20, 4 through 6, John 1, 6 through 8, and 19 through 40, 3:23 through 36, 4:1, 5:33 through 36, 10:40 through 41, Acts 1, 5 and 22, 10:37, 11:16, 13:24 through 25, 18:25, and 19:1 through 7, and Josephus, Jewish Antiquities, 18.116 through 119. Bedrock facts concerning John the Baptist include his commencement of baptisms in the Jordan River between AD 26 and 28, his preaching a message of repentance, gathering multiple disciples, Matthew 9:14, 11:2, Mark 2:18, Luke 7:18 and 11:1, and Acts 19:1-7. Baptizing Jesus in the Jordan River and his arrest and imprisonment by Herod Antipas in the castle Machaerus. While in prison, John sent his disciples to question Jesus whether he was the Messiah, Matthew 11:1-9, and Luke 7:18-35. Herod Antipas then had John put to death sometime between AD 28 and 32, Mark 6:14-29, and Josephus, Jewish Antiquities, 18:116-119. Determining the historical reliability of other passages about John the Baptist in the Gospels and Acts would give us even more historical information, but that is beyond the scope of this book. What is laid out above concerning the Baptist is historical bedrock facts known past doubting. How do all these examples compare to the Apostle Paul? Can we time travel to meet him, learn his beliefs, aims, and passions? Yes. Our sources for the historical Paul, his undisputed four letters, are some of the most reliable historical sources in all the ancient world. Wright's analogy of the paleontologist in the epigraph of this chapter aptly describes our present circumstance. For over 99% of people who have lived on the earth, we have no bones to reconstruct who they were, what they believed, and how they lived. As the four examples above illustrate, for the remaining 1%, we have few and precious bones to build with, though they are enough to draw a fairly accurate portrait. Paul is part of a very elite group from the ancient world for whom we have an abundance of trustworthy sources. To meet the historical Paul, we have just about all the bones we need, reliable and early sources, to know his beliefs, his aims, and even his heroes. Get in the phone booth. We are going to do some time traveling to meet the Pharisaic persecutor transformed into the apostle of the crucified Nazarene. That'll be the end of this week's reading of Dr. Justin Bass's book, The Bedrock of Christianity. Just as the rain started picking up outside again, so we ended just in time. So be sure to check out show notes for links to this week's cigar, and check out the links to Dr. Justin Bass's website where you can pick up copies of his books, and links to his YouTube channel where he has a ton of debates he's done and lectures he's given. Like I said, I'm working my way through them right now, but there's a lot and a lot to learn, a lot to listen to, so make use of those resources. And also check out the link to groundworksministries.com for daily Bible studies and devotionals, and as well the Burning Bush podcast merchandise store where you can pick up some t-shirts, stickers, magnets, mugs to help spread word about the show and tell your friends. And again, thanks a lot for stopping by. Really appreciate it. And until next week, have a great day, have a great cigar, and God bless.